You guys didn't just play 90s music. I mean, you had spiky bleached hair. You know, you wore the baggy clothes, everything.
Yes, sir. Yes.
The long and the short of it was, you know, yeah, we kind of, bands like Korn and bands like, you know, House of Pain, we were kind of friends with those guys. We were also kind of like idolized those guys because they were so cool. So, yeah, the chain wallets and yeah, all that stuff.
Right. I got a big one. Third rail clothing.
Oh, third rail. Yep. Oh, there was some of the clothing.
Baggy and like fire and flames.
Baseball
and
jackets. Oh my gosh. We were all so, you know, we experimented. I got my chin pierced when I just,
you did? Oh, yeah. It was like one night after.
Just one night at the Roxbury. You know?
Do you remember JNCO jeans?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce it. Saved by the 90s. That is Stan Frazier and Murphy Kurgis, two of the founding members of Sugar Ray. And as you can see, the 90s had just as big of an influence on them as they had on us. So today we'll talk about the formative years of one of the biggest 90s bands around. Saved by the 90s! So let's start today's show with my favorite question. Why? Why did the 90s matter so much? What happened that made it so iconic? Why is it so fun to remember it? Is it just because we just happen to be that age and it's interesting to us now because it's been 20-something years? Or was there some special sauce? Here's Stan and Murphy again.
What were the 90s? It was so weird, you know?
It was a little bit of a faceless decade because the 80s were so colorful and neon coming out of the 70s, a transformation from the 70s to the 80s. So the 90s, like, what were the 90s? You look back, I think you can kind of get it now.
And, well, yeah, I don't think we got it until now. I mean, the 90s are finally receiving nostalgia. Before that, it was just like a few years ago. And now you can really compare it to what music and pop culture is like today.
I think so.
Yeah. And what a big difference from like, you know, 91, 92 to like 98, 99. I mean, it was like almost like 3 decades in 1 decade. It went from, you know, just this thing out of the 80s and then this kind of like transitional period and then like at the end of the 90s. Yeah, I guess it was sort of a blur to me, a lot of it too. Right. Murphy journaled a lot back in the days of Sugar Ray, so he has a lot of the specifics on like just everything. I don't know, you probably have a lot of stuff, don't you, Murph? Like as far as like culture wise, like what was popular, what wasn't, what songs we were playing, what food we were eating. I don't know, you have all that stuff written down.
And he reads through it every day.
I have nothing. No. I have a lot of it, yes. You do need to get away from it a little bit. When something is too close to you, you don't have perspective on it, like anything. And when you kind of get away, you go, you know what? There was some really great music in the 90s going on. So I think that you have to have a little distance from it to really see what it is. And I think any decade, you're going to look at it and go, there's some amazing bands, and there were some bands that, you know, flamed out and they had one hit or something. But I think there was a ton of amazing music that came through the time.
And one of those amazing bands, of course, turned out to be Sugar Ray. Hits like Fly, Every Morning, Someday, When It's Over, just unforgettable music from these guys. But it didn't always start so simply. They had a few other incarnations of the band that eventually led to who they became. So here's Stan telling us about the early days.
We got together, you know, Murphy and I was dating Murphy's sister in high school.
You gotta go back to the beginning.
Okay.
We started as a band up PCH, literally just up the road in Newport. Yeah. That's where we started. He called me one day and said, hey, they were in a band called the Tories, and you guys were insane. They were a really, really, really amazingly talented band at the high school level. They won the Battle of the Bands here in Laguna Beach. I remember I came down and saw that.
Back in 1904.
And they were so good. Their singer quit, so Rodney, who was on bass, switched to guitar. He goes, hey, wanna come down and play bass? Like, Rodney switched to guitar. I go, what? Okay. All right. Cool. At the beach. And so it literally started that day. Mark came down. He said, I knew a guy who wants to sing. And it started on the beach there. Our first gig was on the beach. And we were the Shrinking Inks at that point. It took evolutions and went down the road. But Mark joined, you know, we were all from the beginning, day one. We started.
Mark used to like roadie gear for our old band, the Tories. Like we had a high school band, and Mark would just be praying to like carry an amp or like, you know, push my drums through the, you know, he was just dying to be in the business, but he knew he probably didn't have like the strong enough chops and the vocals and whatever, but he was a really, you know, funny guy and he had a great personality. And he just one day, I think he just said, you know, hey, I can do what these guys are doing. Like I'll just, you know, fake it till I make it sort of philosophy.
Yeah.
And he did an amazing job. Yeah, we were the Shrinky Dinks, and you know we were kind of we were a full cover band.
We were raised on Volcom and Quicksilver parties. We actually started the year that Volcom started as a company. We played their first ever party, 91. Long history, fun stuff.
Yeah, it came full circle too. And you know we started as the Shrinky Dinks playing all these things, and you know and then it became like we were going to get a record deal. Like all of a sudden it got serious. I mean, obviously there was ups and downs. Mark quit for a minute and then he came back for the band after, you know, he graduated from college, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, dude,
McGee deserves a lot of credit for us getting the deal because we shot a video back then.
Let's say who McGee is. Do you know who McGee is?
No, I don't.
Okay, great. Okay. McGee is, sorry to interrupt you, Murph. Okay. McGee is you know, he was like the fifth Beatle.
Right.
You know, he was the guy that couldn't really play the instrument, but he had a vision and he saw an opportunity, and so he started like directing our videos and stuff. But he had a vision, you know, outside of being a musician to kind of help us reach our goals and see what we are fully capable of. And you know, he went on to be, he's a huge successful director in Hollywood right now. He directed the Charlie's Angels, you know, all those
Terminator
movies.
Terminator 4.
Oh,
cool. Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has a house in
Newport.
So
he hooked you up with Atlantic one way or another?
Well, no. What happened was he had a vision, though, to shoot a video on 35mm film in 91, which is insane. That's like trying to shoot something on like IMAX today, like a local band. I'm going to shoot it on 65mm. You know, Quentin Tarantino style. So we did that, and it just was lightning in a bottle. We picked the right song. It wasn't a hit, but it was just a full of energy riff. And he filmed us in all these amazing places where we were just doing all the... We had so much energy. The four of us together were like... It was just like keg powder waiting to explode when we got into a car or a room or a place.
We were a bunch of hams. I mean, yeah, that's... And McGee saw that.
He just wanted to have fun. These guys
are insane. If I tell them to go jump off that cliff, they'll go jump off that cliff.
Yeah, they'll hurt themselves.
As long as the camera's rolling, like, we really were. We were like...
We wanted to hurt ourselves.
We were dying for attention. Our musicality was pretty damn good. The songwriting was definitely not there yet, but we were definitely the most sort of, like, exciting thing. We all just said, you know, if we're going to be a monkey, we might as well be a gorilla. Let's be the biggest, you know, ape we can be and just go for it.
And then a miracle happened. Somehow these guys got on the desk of the executive of one of the biggest record labels in the world.
With McGee helping us doing this video, that was this vision that somehow Doug Morris from Atlantic, it got to him magically somehow.
It's a crazy
story how this demo video got to the president of Atlantic on
in
the
New
East
York
Coast.
City.
It's insane. It's like a magic carpet ride there. He saw it, and this is when, you know, there was a lot of grunge going on, a lot of like flannel and staring, we called it staring issues. He said literally this. He goes, sign that band. Give them whatever they want. That's why I got into music in the first place.
Wow.
Doug Morris said that. He's the head of a major, the big conglomerate labels. Anyway, he's a Vanguard guy. And he saw something, though, in us, like a little spark. And so anyways, we somehow lucked out on that. Now we go, okay, now we got to write a record. We had like two songs.
And the one
in the video got us the deal. So.
And what song is that?
It was Caboose.
Okay.
And it was a great live song. It had so much energy.
All right, cool track, but not exactly the mellow pop that we've come to know and love about Sugar Ray. That sound didn't really stick until Sugar Ray broke with the song that everybody knew, everybody sang along to with not only their friends, but also their mom. The cross-generational multi-platinum hit, Fly.
Fly came later in 97 on the second record when we were writing in New York City out of frustration. We didn't, like, oh, you tried to change your sound. I dare any band to try to change the sound and have it sound good. It just sounds bad. So we somehow backed into that song one day in rehearsal when everybody was frustrated, and then our lives changed.
You know, we all wrote Fly. I wrote the chorus. I was responsible for a lot of the choruses, but Murphy came up with the bass line, and Mark wrote some lyrics, and our DJ came up with the drum beat, and Rodney played the guitar. So, like, we were all responsible for a lot of the songwriting.
It's 1997, and Sugar Ray has made it. Fly's been number one on the Billboard charts for 4 weeks. Their album would eventually become triple platinum. But the guys were faced with a lot of criticism that this would be it, that they were a one-hit wonder. What else could this band possibly do? Well, they were set out to prove everybody wrong.
So we had the one song that was seriously number one, And it blew open every door. We started to realize our dreams. We all got gold records.
We're on the Warped Tour, selling 55,000 copies a week, which is insanity.
I mean, literally crying to my parents, like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, that kind of emotion and just thankfulness and gratefulness. And then, people were like, well, they didn't have another follow-up single. These guys are a flash in the pan. What else? We'll never hear from them again. So the album cycle finished, and we went off, and we went into the studio up in Los Angeles. We were all living there at the time, and we just started writing another record. And now we had money in the bank, and we had time, and we had a nicer studio, and we had nicer equipment, and we could afford to be in the studio and order, you know, instead of ordering, you know, or having, like, you know, top ramen, we were ordering, like, nice food. And it just became it changed us. It opened our doors. We just started writing, and you know, you can't ever predict what's going to come up when you write songs. I mean, I'm a songwriter to this day and producer, and so is Murphy, but it's hard. It's really hard.
Let me say a little on what I think happened. It did change the fabric of the band, and it let out the real good songwriters, and I think Rodney and Stan, that had something like Beach Boy element buried inside you, where when we were banging our heads, it wasn't able to come out before. You know what I'm saying? And that's when Every Morning came and Someday came, because the fact that Fly was then unlocked. So then we were free to go, oh, we can sing harmony and just chill and make a cool beat and go and just do that. It let everybody in the band be free to write a mellow song with a BPM that wasn't 160. Okay, cool, let's do this. So that's where I think it unlocked us to let us have a chance at doing another record. And we didn't at all try to go, let's write another Fly. Let's copy. We were free to kind of sing and do some breezy, mellower stuff. And it actually worked in the next. And we called it 1459.
Yeah.
Because we were trying to beat critics to the punch of going, look, we get it. You all think we're going to fail. And we probably think but we're going to try. So here's
14 minutes, 59 seconds.
What you're thinking. So let's just have some fun.
And then to back that up with Every Morning, which I think is as big as Fly. Right. Was it chart-wise as big as Fly?
Yeah.
It must have been.
I think Fly actually trumps it all. But
I think Fly trumps it all, but it's right there. Every Morning is the one that's right next to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, to back that statement up with a song like that is pretty cool. You know, to be able to say, look at us, we're still doing it.
We lucked out. Every morning there's a halo hanging from the corner of my girlfriend's four-post bed. I know it's not mine, but I'll see if I can use it for the weekend or a one-night stand. Couldn't understand how to work it out. Once again, as predicted, left my broken heart open and you ripped it out. So we'd come up with the music for that tune in the studio, and we were doing it at the... what was the place?
Studio 56.
Studio 56. Yeah. It was in L.A. right on the...
Remember your house?
It's like by the transsexual shakies right there where there's... It's totally. Like, you know, trannies everywhere. And we were just like...
Trannies and grannies.
L.A. was amazing. It was great. I walked down the boulevard one time in hot pants for a dare. I got $100 from our
tiny, tiny Daisy Dukes. We dared him to walk down. You were in a wig.
I was in a wig.
I was just like... I was just looked twice.
Channeling some weird shit.
Exactly. Los Angeles.
Right on, Taylor. Exactly.
But the long and the short of it is we had the riff for Every Morning. It's a 3-chord riff. We kind of like borrowed from Lou Reed and every other song in the world. I just went on a camping trip. Every great song in the world is 3 chords. I learned like 25 songs this weekend to go on this camping trip. They're all 3 chords. I'm like, this is the greatest thing in the world. Like, that's all you need. You know, 3 chords and the truth or whatever they say. So the long and the short of it, I went out to the car. I was leaving the studio for the day. I was hearing the melody in my head. All of a sudden, the lyrics just popped in, and I ran back in, and our engineer, Steve Gallagher, was in there.
Hi, Steve.
And I go, throw up a vocal mic. I got a melody, I got a hook, and I got a lyric. It all just popped into my head. Every morning, there's a halo hanging from the corner of my girlfriend. I was fighting with my girlfriend. She thought I was cheating, and I don't know what it was. Sometimes I sit down and I work really hard for lyrics. Like, I'll strive.
It was from somewhere else.
Yeah, it came from the heavens.
The best stuff comes from the seas.
I was dating a girl at the time, and like I said, we had Fly, you know, Fly hit, and so we were all able to kind of like breathe a little bit. And I bought a bed, right? Like, what's the first thing
you're
gonna do?
It was a killer bed.
But I mean, it was a killer bed. Long gone were the days of sleeping on, you know, the futon on the floor with the cat piss and everything. You know, we finally got our own places. And
Stan has style too. It was a killer bed. It was a giant 4-post, like Indonesian wood. It's amazing,
you know,
giant.
That's kind of how I pictured it.
It was that.
That's it.
Yes.
So
yes.
I got this. We got this 4-post bed with my girlfriend. She picked it out, but I'm like, okay, cool, whatever. It looks nice. And so then, like, I don't know, we were in a band. So she was always like curious that who you who are you with? Are you, who's that, you know, who's calling you? Or who's that girl that was asking you a question? Or it just like seems so shady that I was doing some shady stuff.
Right.
I might have been. I don't remember. I don't think I was. I think I was good.
You were.
Like, maybe.
No. But so, you know, every morning there's a halo hanging on the corner of my girlfriend's four-post bed, which just meant like she's so innocent and I'm out there doing all this stuff. But I know it's not mine, but I know you use it for the weekend or a one night stand. So it's just like, you're so holy and great. And I'm this scumbag out there, you know, banging chicks. But can I just borrow some of your greatness for a little bit? Like, that's all it was just like, gosh, man, you hang this halo on the four post bed.
And then you hear the interpretations of the, you know, other people, interviewers or magazines or they're like, oh, that was an excuse to cheat or so, you know, people interpret. And that's the beauty about music though. Like they can listen to a lyric and you get something slightly different out of it. And why not? I mean, it's like, it was a great hook.
But I came back in and I threw that down and no one else had heard it. And everyone arrived at the studio next day and I arrived early and I put a low harmony under it just so everyone could hear it in its true form. And everyone hit the floor. Everyone's like, oh my God, this is like, this is better than Fly. And I go, I don't know what it is. It just can't. And is it a chorus? Is it a verse? Is it a bridge? I don't know. And then it ended up being the chorus.
Right.
But it was just so weird how like cool, I ran back part. In. I'm like, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go home for the night, maybe drink a few beers. But I ran back in. I'm like, if I don't go in, it's before iPhones and I didn't have a voice recorder. I'm like, I'm going to forget
those little ghetto blasters that you know.
I'm going to forget the melody. And that, you know, it turned out to be a really important move for me to run back in there and do it. You know, it probably made me a lot of money and helped our career. That we had a second follow-up single that was number one.
And like I said, I think Fly gave Stan and us the opportunity to just explore melodic stuff that was sitting and waiting inside them. You know,
so that's a good point.
It was fun for me to watch that. I was more the hard rock guy, the riff. And so that's what I love doing. And I'm listening to these guys write these hooks. And I'm like, then Rodney's little dun, 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 dun. That's a magical guitar part. And you know, if you play it to a kid, they're just like, whoa. It was a fun moment to be in right there during that record because we weren't thinking at all. We were just in the studio screwing around. Put a basketball hoop in our recording studio. And we did. And a Bruce Lee poster and like guitars. Yeah. And anybody could go in at any time and play anything or screw around and play, you know, a pinball and then write a song. I mean, that's how it should be. Right?
And you just said the most poignant thing. You're like, we weren't thinking. And I think once you start thinking a lot about, and because I do this for a living every day still, and I have to do it. And you have to like, writer's block bullshit. You have to force the issue. But back then, when you have the luxury of having a hit song on the radio and you have time, you can kind of not think. You can kind of just go, what are we doing today? And we walk into the studio always and go, all right, what are we eating? Like, that's the first thing ordered.
And we had each other too. You said that we had other things, but I think that the fact that we're having so much fun and we were out on the road together, you know, it wasn't extravagant success at that point. It really wasn't. I mean, it was funny. At one point I asked our A&R guy, were we ever going to get a check? Because literally a year after Fly was breaking, we were broke. I was like $100 a week. And he's like, Murph, you know, anybody ever had a hit record, never had a problem playing for Pampers. He made some funny like rock and roll joke that like, don't worry, you're going to get your money at some point. But it, you know, it was cool that we were able to get a house or something or whatever. But it was, I think we had each other too. It was really fun that we were connected at that
time.
We were getting along so well at that time. And it was fun to show up at the studio. Unlike later years when it becomes a drag and a slog or whatever. You got to fight through it. But that was a magical, fun time that we all look back on.
Sugar Ray ended up being one of the only bands in the decade that kind of towed the line between this beachy, soft rock pop sound and the actual hard rockers that they thought of themselves as. So when they were paired up with other equally popular 90s acts, they couldn't help but feel a little out of place.
I have a poster in my garage and I see it all the time. And we did this thing, a big radio show in New Jersey, and Britney Spears headlined, you know, and 98 Degrees was there. And Sugar Ray's on the bill. And it's like so weird because I think back, I'm like, you know, you got all the people dancing and doing all the moves and all the kind of fluff. And then you got us and, you know, we're you know, we've got three bottles of Stoli in the dressing room and like
we're listening to Korn.
Yeah. You know? Like Rodney's weeding out everywhere. Like, I mean, it's just, like, we weren't that boy band, but a lot of people thought we were. A lot of
I think, and they're
a lot
like, of people you write your own stuff. I'm like, we're a band.
Yeah,
isn't every band write
you don't
all
play
their
a track?
Own songs?
No, we mess up every night. Yeah. We play great, but sometimes, you know, there's a bunch of booze on stage. I mean, we were a real band. I mean, there's no question.
So it was
about
funny
it.
To play with those acts. I remember that show really well.
Yeah.
And I took pictures of Britney Spears when, you know, I had a camera. I was like the band nerd, computer nerd. I did the website and all that stuff, and I did tour journals. I had a giant Sony Mavica pick camera They took floppy disks in the side.
Oh, man. End of the night. Awesome.
That's so funny.
A long time ago. Anyways, but it was fun to play with those bands because we had a huge song in the radio. That's what afforded us that weird slot. It's
and just
a
big then we song. Befriended people like NSYNC and stuff, like Joey Fatone and all those guys. They were really, really cool. They came into our dressing room.
They were
you
nice.
Know, they thought Sugar Ray was Mark. Everyone thought he was Sugar. You know, that was a big thing in the 90s. Yeah. Hey, Sugar!
Yeah.
You know, they thought he was Sugar Ray. You know, so
but then when they meet everybody else, they're like, oh,
yeah,
you guys
then
are
they
cool.
realize, it's oh, just, you guys are a rock band just, and you're drinking, Jack Daniels. I see.
Right.
You know?
One special thing about Sugar Ray is how cross-generational their music was and is. So I asked Stan and Murphy, do people still come up to you, comment how important their music was to them, and how does it make them feel?
We still get that. I mean, we've been playing.
That's a blessed feeling. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling to get.
We've been playing in this other, band with Charlie, the guy from Train, and some other guys, the Pawn Shop Kings, and we kind of have this thing going on, and we do a bunch of different songs, some Train songs, some Sugar Ray songs, and we had a gig a couple weeks ago, and these people came up to us after the gig, and we were signing autographs, and people were like, that was so cool. I cannot believe how important those songs to me. Because people, maybe they were like younger when those songs, but that they know them through their parents now, which is so weird. You know, it's like generational now. My wife called me 2 days ago. She was in the grocery store and she heard, I think she heard Someday. Yeah. And it's just like, it's so cool that we still have the recurrent airplay to this day. I mean, it's not like, I don't know. It's one of those things that we're very blessed. We're lucky as hell. But yeah, it's a trip that the songs today in 2016, they mean things to people that weren't even around during those times.
I think you're
right.
They
weren't even
born yet. It's cross-generational. I mean, I was 11 when the 1999 album came out.
Right.
When Every Morning came out. Right. And I remember listening to it with my mom in the car. And we both loved it.
That's
we
awesome.
Still do.
That's right.
And I think that's probably true of everybody. So in 2001, Sugar Ray released a self-titled album called Sugar Ray. That's probably the last record you really remember from the band. It had the hit song, When It's Over, which, ironically, turned out to be kind of their last hit. Here's the guys commenting on that realization.
So it is ironic now, looking back at that. That is like, we released a bunch of stuff after When It's Over and none of it worked. So, it's very appropriate that When It's Over is
right
now. It should have been called Now It's Over,
Yeah. No, that was the last, you're right. That was the last big song for us. And I think that there was just you just get these creative runs. And it's the energy between people. It maybe it kind of goes away and then it goes to another, place. But that was the last one. And that video was actually trivia. That was the most expensive video we ever did. You remember that?
It was a cool video.
Yeah,
that was cool. I mean, McGee
directed $500,000.
He directed all those videos for us, our director friend.
Really?
Yes, $500,000. That was right in the tail end of when record sales were still huge and you know, huge money being made.
Yeah.
So, but I just thought that was funny. It was an expensive video.
Spending $500,000.
And specifically, everybody's dream scenario. That's what you kick stuff over, but your dream scenario was kind of like a really kind of rad, like, was it like a Sting set or like
a
Sade
like Style Council or something, just like really sexy and like suits.
And you look kind of like take over the band, like you push Mark off the stage.
Exactly.
Like the drummer becomes the lead singer.
You've done your homework.
Yeah.
Was that what you wanted in? But that was just Stan's personality. Like he'd have fun. He would just destroy things, which was rad. Mine was like a punk rock CBGB, and I did a stage dive at Liberty Spikes. Craig was in the club,
making
it rain. Mark was, what was his?
He was the drummer.
No, that would have been great.
That's funny.
No, I think Mark's,
remember.
Didn't he have that big mural in the background?
To Those Who Have Passed? Is that from the
Exactly.
Every Morning Booklet?
Yeah.
I guess so.
Singing Real.
Yeah, that's right. It was like a very tight shot on him. But what was Rodney's dream scenario for a video?
Bruce Lee thing.
Oh, that's right. That was cool. Yeah. That was fun because...
That was fun to spend $500,000
If you want a band to say yes to a video concept, just do something that they would love to do.
Yeah, play
to their
whatever
ego.
Whatever you want, it up.
They'll vote that treatment. Yes, that director wins. We're hiring him.
Well, he didn't even have to write a treatment. It's like, what do you want to do?
I know.
Okay, done.
That's how we'd approach every video with McGee. It's just like, what do we want to do that's fun?
Yeah.
Make it cool.
Yeah. When it's over, that's the time I fall in love again. When it's over, that's the time you're in my heart again. And when you go, 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 I know it never ends, never ends. All the things that I used to say, all the words that got in the way.
to know have gone out the window.
So when it's over, that was it.
That was it. Yeah, that was, and you're right. It was 2001, 2002.
Yeah.
We actually, that wasn't quite it. we went through the mud for about 10 years after that.
Oh,
we kept, we kept going.
In the pursuit of failure? Yeah. I mean, leisure?
We just, you know what? The world had spoken, I think, and I don't know. We didn't really have the material. And like Murphy's,
but that's the truth.
I think the most important thing you said was the energy created between people really, I think, creates the vibe in the song. Yeah. You know, like if you have, you know, some kind of angst towards somebody else, it shows up in the room, and that you're not going to get the song. Like he was talking about when we wrote Every Morning, there was no angst. It was like, yeah, there's a basketball hoop. We can order food. Mm-hmm. Everyone's getting along. You show up at noon. I'll show up at two. Stan's going
to... Let's go to Jones tonight.
Stan's gonna going to stay early and try to write
some
books.
Of monkeys?
But no one was like, hey, you know, like, it just didn't... It didn't get... The bad vibes weren't there. It was just good vibes. And I think that's true in life or marriage or anything. It's like, you know, if the bad vibes are there, man, things go awry.
Yeah.
So there, you've kind of heard the saga, the highs, the lows, how it started, how it ended. So what do two former members of one of the biggest bands of all time do now?
I'm actually directing a lot of stuff, shooting a lot of video production and photography and doing that, just keeping busy filming stuff and staying creative and making things, you know. So,
you know, I guess since 2012, you know, I left the band and I pursued some culinary stuff. My two passions have always been food and music. So I opened up this pizza place in Newport Beach called Sergeant Pepperoni's, ironically.
Awesome.
It's been a pizza place since the 70s, but we took it over and revamped it. And we're looking for a second one. We might do one in Laguna Beach.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Sergeant Pepperoni's, shameless plug. So, and then, you know, I got back into music in 2013. I just kind of said, I'm going to go back to work and I'm going to start writing again. And I found a girl who's 19 and her name's Claire Wright. And we just got her signed to Epic Records, producing her record with my partner at 17th Street Recording Studios in Costa Mesa. And that's what we're just doing. We're finding artists, we're developing them, writing with them, and getting them signed. So still in music, hardcore.
Cool.
In fact, writing the best stuff of my life right now, just like with all the, you know, negativity and stuff that kind of came out of the end of our band that kind of got a little nasty. Like I used that as fuel to kind of like really kind of take off and you know, go into real hardcore songwriting.
Yeah, just
do the right thing.
The guys are also in a supergroup, a new one by the name of the Painbirds, who happens to be supporting the radio station that is the home to this show, Saved by the 90s, called KX93.5. If you're hearing this before September 30th, 2016, well, you can catch them live at the Montage. KX93.5.com for tickets. Here's Stan on the origin of that band.
I started working with Charlie Colleen, who was the bass player and wrote a lot of the songs for Train.
Yeah.
He wrote Drops of Jupiter and some of the other big hits for those guys. And we just started talking. I mean, it's kind of like the band Orphan situation where there's a bunch of bands that have had members come and go that kind of are just like on this island and they want to still create and do cool things. But, you know, for whatever reason, the band that they were in prior to that just doesn't work anymore. So Murphy and I, you know, I introduced Murphy to Charlie. And then there's, you know, Charlie knows everybody in the industry. So Charlie's connected to Jeff Skunk Baxter, who was in Steely Dan and Doobie Brothers, and just
and you did that one first show at Lido Theater. That was
we
really
did a show
fun.
At the Lido
that,
Cinema about a year ago, and then you know we involved Joel and Scott Owen from the Pawn Shop Kings. They're an amazing duo, brothers from Newport Beach by way of like Alabama. Is it Alabama or where are they? Mississippi or somewhere down there?
The South.
The South. Yeah. They're from and they're super cool. They're like the. They're just the coolest thing in the world. So we brought them in. So it's Murphy, myself, Charlie from Train. We've got Jeff Skunk Baxter, the guys from Pawn Shop Kings. And then there's a couple other guys that Tom Luce is an amazing musician from San Francisco. He's had a couple hits up there. And, you know, it's kind of a revolving door, you know. We're friends with Andrew McMahon. Charlie's really good friends with Andrew. And it's kind of like I said, a revolving door of guys that kind of want to come in and play a few songs. Maybe we play that band's songs, our band's covers. Maybe we play something we've never even done before. So we've done a string of gigs, and now we're going to start to do some more stuff. And it's been really positive.
See
and cool.
What it turns into. Yeah,
yeah, it's super awesome to have the outlet where we can, you know, we're making new music. We can do the covers. We can go ahead and just do whatever we want, really.
Yeah.
You know, there's no set rule. It's like, all right, let's just play.
And finally, the way I like to close every show, a question I'm asking every guest. The 90s were such a big influence on us, and Sugar Ray was such a big influence on us. But what thing other than that influenced them most from that decade?
Well, yeah, I feel like you want to say something really, you know, like Will Smith's, you know, get up and, you know.
So just like pure 90s.
Yeah, that is. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know that Adidas shell toes. No, I don't know. I mean, a record stands out to me that like was an artist that was so iconic and amazing. I mean, I listened to early in the 90s. I think it was 91. I heard Jeff Buckley. Hmm. And that's not really a fashion statement or anything, but sure. It was a record that was so amazing and iconic. It just, I remember hearing it for the first time we were overseas, and it just blew my mind apart, and just listening to that guy. But in terms of fashion statements, I'll have to keep thinking about that.
All right, you let me know.
Yeah, I want to keep thinking. I mean, the fact, like you hit it earlier, kind of like the chain wallety baggy pants thing, man. Was like, I guess I jumped on the chain wallet thing for a minute, right, but also because I lose my wallet every 15 seconds anyway.
You should bring it back then.
I probably
back
should.
The chain wallet.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. That's a good. Well, because everything else is sick.
Did you have a chain wallet then?
I had, yeah, because I would always lose my.
Okay, then I'll say frosted tips.
Frosted.
I actually didn't frost them. What I did was I would bleach my hair, you know, white, but it would go yellow. Uh-huh. But then when it grows out, it looks like
it gets frosted.
So I'll just say frosted
Murphy,
tips.
I thought you were going to say Nirvana and like the Seattle thing, because like Murphy was super into that.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and
true. No, you're right.
Alice in Chains and like that whole Seattle grunge thing was like,
sure.
It was
my
pretty,
favorite
it was
thing
pretty
of all
hard
time.
Not to pay attention to that.
Alice in Chains and Nirvana were just
I think
gigantor.
That was kind of like the opposite, though, of what we were feeling in Sugar Ray. You know, we were like, those guys are killer, and they have angst and flannels, and they're all doing like heroin and shit. But we were like, we're at the beach, like we're playing acoustic guitar. We're having, let's go have some.
That's
like,
what made you stand
but
out.
But that's what made us interesting because I might have brought this little edge over here, and you brought in that little thing, and then this thing, and then you put it together in like a flour tortilla, and you have a tasty burrito.
Dude, I'll have some chips with that, please, down at Wahoo's.
That's a good way to put it, Murph. All right, Stan Fraser and Murphy Kurgis from Sugar Ray. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's been really fun.
Saved by the 90s is the show, and you can find more on the podcast, on the iTunes store, or at kx935.com. Thank you, guys. We'll
thank you.
Soon.
Thank you.
Awesome talk.
Someday, when my life has passed me